Listening to Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 on your FM dial, here on a lovely Wednesday afternoon. Man, feels like springtime. It's really clear out there. We'll have weather. We'll give you the weather here really quick to start things off for the Moscow Pullman area. For those of you listening elsewhere, please forgive us for this brief interruption of the rest of our show. It's 52 degrees at Moscow Pullman Regional Airport. Wind speeds out of the southeast at 12 miles per hour. And visibility 10 miles. It's looking like partly cloudy in tonight in the low 30s. And mostly cloudy with a chance of rain tomorrow morning, possibly turning into snow later on. Thanks for joining us here. A few brief public service announcements to get things started. City of Moscow Green Building Program Information Workshop, March 9th at 7 p.m. in the Moscow City Council Chambers, which is at 3rd and Washington Street. You can come learn about green building and resource conservation in our community. This voluntary building program proposed is part of the City of Moscow Community Development Program. And just as they've been doing every Friday night since the War on Terror entered the country of Iraq for the second time in recent memory, those great folks over at the Palouse Peace Coalition have been at Friendship Square in Moscow with signs, flags, banners, buttons, literature, and the knowledge that they are right and that our government is wrong. And you can join them in protesting our presence in the Middle East every Friday from 5:30 to 6:30 downtown Moscow.
Right at Friendship Square. And well, we've got quite a show lined up here. Yeah. Here on KRFP Moscow. Make sure everybody knows you're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. And you queuing up some music there, Will, or do you want to get right in with the program?
Let's go on into it.
All right. Well, we got a bunch of segments here. We're going to talk. We're going to introduce a new segment of our show, talking about some of the great drainages, the concept of watersheds. We've talked a lot about watersheds here. We're going to describe a few of the watersheds in the Wild Clearwater Country and tell some stories about them. And we're going to begin that segment here today.
And we'll begin
at the very bottom end, talking about the South Fork Clearwater, but also some adjacent watersheds that are related, and we consider them part of the Wild Clearwater Country, like Slate Creek, which eventually flows into the Salmon, and some of the drainages flow south rather than north into the Clearwater. For example, the Gospel Hump, Sheep Creek, and some others go south, and Bargaman Creek and whatnot, though we all consider that kind of part of the Wild Clearwater Country. Anything north of that main stem of the Salmon as it's shooting west there toward Riggins. So we'll talk a little bit about those today. So we're going to have some discussion on the South Fork Clearwater.
That sounds good. Drainage is water. The rivers of the west really define a lot of the West, especially in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The powerful Snake, Clearwater, and Salmon rivers can't be missed. We're also going to talk about we know it's March, but we're still going to have one more week of Small Owl Month, Small Owls in the Clearwater. We've been talking for 3 weeks now about these small woodland owls, and today will be our conclusion. So we'll do a little review and hopefully listen to some owl vocalizations, and also talk about our last two owls. We're going to try to crunch two owls into today's segment, so we'll try to slow it down so we don't cram you with too much information too fast, but I think you'll be interested in learning about these last two owls. And then we'll even have time to talk about some land sales.
Land sales and some very interesting news. It's The Bush administration has proposed to sell off some of the national forests. And the opposition to this proposal is coming from some unexpected sources. We'll talk about that a little bit today and some of the latest news on that proposal. And we'll talk about how that may affect the wild Clearwater country. So stay tuned with us. And Will, looks like you're going to queue up something to play for us here.
A little music from Little Hawk. Hope you enjoy it.
You knew they were coming, knew you had to run. These white men in blue coats and their loaded guns headed out for Pine Ridge, though it was so cold. Mostly women and children, the rest were mostly old. Major Samuel Whiteside seemed a decent man. Knew Bigfoot was sick and gave a helping hand. Bullets will not go towards you. 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 Set up camp at Wounded Knee as the sun went down. Crazy Horse's heart was somewhere close around. Later in the darkness, Forsyth's troop moved in, took charge away from Whiteside. The story now begins. Forsyth had a bad heart, knew the time had come. The rubbing out of the Redskins, for him it was so fun. Bullets will not go to war. Bullets will not go towards you. Bullets will not go towards you. Bullets will not go towards you. Morning brought the bugle call, time to be alone. Come out to the center, time to be disarmed. Yellow bird did protest at some ghosts and steps. Then there was a gunshot, guess what happened next? The sound, it was deafening, the air was filled with smoke. Forsyth and his men got what they had hoped. Bodies, they were scattered, lying in the snow. Mostly women and children, as we all do.
Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. That's Little Hawk. That track's entitled Wounded Knee from the self-titled album Little Hawk, 1492 to 1975. And for more about this artist and his music, you can find him on the web, www.arborrecords.com, out of Winnipeg, Canada. Well, the last week of the Small Owl in the Wild Clearwater Country, that's today. And we've talked about three species so far. Talked about the northern pygmy owl, western screech, the boreal owl.
Very interesting.
And today we will wrap up with two, the saw-whet and the flammulated owl.
Oh, yeah.
We have some connections. These owls aren't independent of one another. Some are closely related. And so we'll make some connections for you between the ones we talk about today and ones we, the few others that we've already been spending some time with. The flammulated owl. An owl I've yet to see. Gary, have you seen a flammulated owl in the wild?
I've seen one.
Have you?
I've seen one flammulated.
Man.
That was not in the state of Idaho. That was down in Utah.
Okay.
And some of the ponderosa pine country down on the Dixie National Forest.
All right. That's I've seen only plates and photos, but wow, what an amazingly beautiful owl.
Yeah, I was with somebody that knew what they were doing, so okay. We were able to.
Did you see it or hear
it?
Yeah,
we actually got a glimpse of it.
Oh wow,
really glimpse. The person was out calling them, doing a study. So
fantastic, flammulated owl, the only of these small owls that have purely dark brown eyes.
Yeah,
the rest have yellow eyes.
Yeah, they're these dark eyes. Of course, we didn't get that good of a look to tell, but it was rather interesting. Yeah,
their scientific name is Otis flammeolus, and we talked a little bit about this genus earlier. The same genus that used to house the western eastern screech owls, which have now been moved because of their relationship to New World owls. They decided that the eastern and western screech were more New World owls, and flammulated has some Old World connections. There's a lot of Otis worldwide, a lot of Otis species in Africa and in the Old World. So Otis flammeolus remained the flammulated owl. It's recognized by its completely dark brown eyes that are not found in any other small owl, and it is about the size of a northern pygmy owl, about 6 3/4
tiny little
inches.
Thing.
Yeah, a pretty small owl. No tufts.
No.
Well, I take that back. They do have tufts. I'm sorry. I'm skipping over to Sawwet. Almost like a miniature screech owl if you were to see a flammulated. And there's some great websites out there. Owling.com is the one with some great photos.
Yes, and sometimes you don't see the tufts on these small owls. That's one of the things that annoys people that, like me, who are not very adept at identifying birds. I'll see something, I've seen some very rare bird, or hey, I've discovered a new species. I get really excited, and then, of course, go back to the book and find out that I was seeing something very common.
You're off the hook though, because the ears are rather short in comparison to the screech owls.
Oh, okay.
So, but these are gray brown birds. They have two phases, a gray phase and a red phase. If you're familiar with screech owls, they're similar. And, a rather dull gray bill. And they're a nocturnal owl. They're strictly a nocturnal.
Yes, they are.
And they're an insectivore.
Mm-hmm.
They stay almost strictly, after bugs.
Yeah, they do. And we were out, and at night they call them, and this guy had a flashlight, you know, out there. So got a glimpse of this thing. It was, you know, or a spotlight or something he had going there. It was somebody doing some research. So it was kind of an interesting and very opportune moment.
Yeah,
to glimpse that. Of course, we assumed that's what it was, having heard it. And well, I'm pretty certain.
You know, a lot of that research for owls, small forest owls, is coming out of the Idaho Bird Observatory, and they began a forest owl banding project in '98 on the Boise Ridge, Lucky Peak down in that area, and they've been monitoring the fall movement patterns of a lot of the birds we've been talking about: northern saw-whets, flammulated boreals, and northern pygmy owls. And it's really the first study in the western U.S. to capture and band a significant number of saw-whets and flammulates during migration. So they're hoping to learn about the timing and the movement patterns for migration, any migration cues that are associated with, I guess, the demographics of these owls, the different age and sex classes. Flammulated owls, just to continue a little bit about their habitat preferences and ecology, they're found in montane forests associated mainly with ponderosa pine in this part of the world, and often intermixed with aspen, where you find aspen, and Douglas fir as well. And During migration, they're often found in wooded areas in the lowlands and in the mountains. And they are an old-growth preference species.
Mm-hmm.
Ecology, they do feed on insects, like we said, and those include moths, beetles, grasshoppers, crickets, and caterpillars. But it does also say that they will occasionally grab a small mammal or a bird. And their foraging tactics, which one thing we've been focusing on quite a bit, they display quite a bit. They hawk, just like you see your Buteos out there hawking, flying around looking for something below to snatch up. And they'll also hover glean. Since they are insectivores, some of their eating or foraging tactics are the same as songbirds. And they'll hover glean. They'll hover next to a branch and glean the insects right off of it. It's kind of neat to see a large bird like an owl exhibiting that kind of behavior. So that's a flammulated owl.
Little flams, those dark eyes.
Dark eyes. One more owl. We're going to try one more thing here. Apologize for the voices in the background here. They say this station's haunted. So I don't know if it's true. Maybe it's just Chris. We're going to try another vocalization.
Give it a shot here.
Let's see what... Let's see what we can do here.
While we humans may be more in tune with the caroling of the robin, the common snipe's message is clear to all other male and...
No, we're not having any luck. Okay, we will... Unfortunately, not bring any vocalizations to you again today. We apologize for that. That's too bad. But if you are online or have that capability, check out owling.com. It's a really good site, and Owl Pages as well. They have some great photos, and they also have some great recordings of all these owls' vocalizations. So on to the last owl. Of the segment here,
the saw wet,
and it's got a friend of the as the boreal owl. They share the same genus, Aegolius, and the saw wet owl is Aegolius acaticus. It's a rather small and tame owl, and I've actually had some close up experiences with saw wets,
and I've never seen a saw wet.
Okay, and my experiences like yours were not in the wild Clearwater country, but I got to spend some time. I went to school in the Midwest, and one of our favorite spots to go in the fall was Hawk Ridge, right above Duluth, Minnesota, during fall raptor migration. And a lot of those birds coming out of the northern Canada and in the prairie provinces of Canada, instead of flying over Lake Superior, they hugged the shoreline and rode the thermals above the bluffs and ridges surrounding the lake, kind of a free ride around the western edge there. And so as they came south, they just kind of curved around the lake. And Hawk Ridge is right there at the edge of Lake Superior. And during the daytime, you spent your time counting and looking for different diurnal raptors, mostly hawks and eagles, some falcons as well. And in the evening, there was an owl banding project going on, and it was focusing on saw wets. And so I got to hold a saw wet in my hand, and sure enough, they really do act rather tame. Even though they're a wild creature, they're kind of, when the shock wears off that they're being held by someone and that they're free to go, they do so. But after this bird was banded, I held it in my hand, and he just laid in my hand and stared up at me in those gigantic eyes, almost look like the eyes of a little toddler. They're just big and they're really just kind of cute looking. After about 10 seconds, he realized that he wasn't pinned down, and he hopped up and flew away.
Oh, wow.
Pretty amazing. But my other saw wet experience was actually right here in Moscow. And I was here in 2000 briefly and was... birding in the arboretum, the old arboretum on the U of I campus, and heard something rather strange and walked over to this tree that was directly next to a major traffic area sidewalk, and there was a fledgling saw wet owl perched in a tree about 7 feet off the ground, right next to the sidewalk, in its downy feathers and all. Just sat there and stared at me.
So it had, obviously the nest had to be close by then.
Yeah, it must have been right there. And so he or she wasn't concerned about me in the least. But I just watched that one for quite a few minutes. And they're quite a striking owl, especially as they get older. And the easiest diagnostic characteristic for a saw-whet owl is a bright white chevron on their forehead. So a little white patch that starts above each eye and comes to the center and down what would be the bridge of the nose. A brilliant white pattern there sets saw-whets apart from any of the other owls we've been talking about. And they're rather small in size, but they are larger than the flammulated and the northern pygmy owl. They're 7 to 8.5 inches. And they do not have ear tufts like the pygmy owl. And they're breeding. They breed throughout the region, and they are rather common in the wild Clearwater country. And
yeah.
They're very difficult to tell from northern pygmy owl by vocalization.
Wow.
Yeah. It's an amazing little owl. They eat mainly small mammals, deer, mice, voles, and shrews. And in Idaho, they tend to eat a higher proportion of very small mammals, those 2 to 15 grams in size, so those mice and voles. And they nest in cavities just as all these other owls do. So if you are out and about in the wild Clearwater country in the evening this time of year, you could hear the northern saw-whet. That's my best artistic interpretation.
Well, that was very good, Will.
There you go.
All right, Northern Saw-whet Owl. And that ends, I guess, our Owls of the Month. And we're pretending like February had 29 days this year. So
that's right.
There we go. Well, we're on to drainages. I think we'll probably talk about those and then talk a little about some news. But South Fork Clearwater is our featured drainage this week. But to introduce the topic, I want to go over some of the geography of the Clearwater River Basin. In particular, the Upper Clearwater is part of what the geologic formation is known as the Idaho Batholith. Now, although it was not one single intrusion, I guess, is the appropriate word, of magma, of molten rock. We tend to refer to the large mountain system in the central part and the north central part of Idaho as the Batholith, although there were a couple of different intrusions there. So the Upper Clearwater is characterized by those intrusions and the rocks from which the Batholith came is mainly granitic in nature. So those granitic rocks, or granite-like rocks, because geologists have very specific names for them, are relatively poor in nutrients. And that speaks to the importance of the defining creature, I think, of the Clearwater, and that's the anadromous fish. So start with the South Fork, a little bit about it and its history here. Well, the South Fork of the Clearwater, the basin is about 750,000 acres in size, and that's sort of a hard figure, I think, to get a head around. Think of it, though, more in the context of a square mile. And if you think of it in that respect, it comes to be about a little bit over 1,000 square miles. So another 100,000 acres in there. So we're looking about 1,100 square miles, a little over that, 1,100 square miles. So imagine a block of land, 1 mile by 1 mile, and line up, let's say, 50 of them and line that up maybe another, 20 wide, and you approximately 1,000 square miles. That's, you know, give or take right there. So an area about 20 miles by 50 miles, and that's about the size of the South Fork of the Clearwater Basin. It is the smallest of the three main tributaries of the Clearwater River, and it's even smaller than perhaps both of the two tributaries from the main branch of the Clearwater, which is the Middle Fork, and those are the Selway and the Lockshaw Rivers. So in terms of acreage, it's not that large. About a quarter of the drainage of this watershed, and when we talk about drainages, we're talking about hydrologic drainages from ridgetop to ridgetop. About a quarter of that is within what's called the Palouse Prairie system, although it's on the Camas Prairie down by Grangeville, just north, in and north of Grangeville. So about a quarter of the drainage is affected by heavily by agriculture and municipal type of activities, and that does have an influence on the water quality of the Clearwater, the South Fork of the Clearwater. It is considered by the state of Idaho as a water quality limited stream. In other words, it is not meeting the goals for clean water, even under state standards, which tend to be much less stringent than they are with the federal government, although the state has jurisdiction over implementation of the Clean Water Act here in Idaho, but because of state failure in the past to properly implement that act, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a federal agency, is looking over the state's shoulder, or supposed to be looking over the state's shoulder, in coming up with plans to clean up Idaho's rivers and streams. Interestingly, some of the historical facts about the South Fork is that not that long ago, 20 years or so ago, some of the streams that were heavily logged, and one being the American River, we'll talk a little bit about that later, was about 200% of normal sedimentation from logging and road building. And because of that, the Forest Service was forced to adopt some standards to protect water quality as well. And still, we have not seen 20 years ago when those standards were first being implemented, and they were finally codified in the 1987 Nez Perce National Forest Plan. The river still has not recovered so that it is considered a clean stream. It is, as I mentioned, water quality limited. There are several major tributaries to the South Fork of the Clearwater. And anybody that's spent some time in the South Fork might recognize these. The largest of these is Red River. And the South Fork is actually the confluence of the Red River and of the American River, is where the South Fork officially begins. And not far from that, just a little bit downstream, the Crooked River comes in. So in a sense, you could say it's those three rivers that form the South Fork Clearwater. But the Red River, Leggett Creek, 20 Mile Creek, Peasley Creek, Mill Creek, the American River, Newsome Creek, Wing Creek, as in the wing of a bird, Cougar Creek, Johns Creek, the Crooked River, 10 Mile Creek, Silver Creek, Meadow Creek, and I want to put a caveat here on Meadow Creek. This is not the famous Meadow Creek roadless area, although it's very near the South Fork. It's just to the east of the South Fork Clearwater, and that Meadow Creek flows north into the Selway, which forms the Middle Fork of the Clearwater when it joins the Lockshaw Lowell. So it's not the famous Wild Meadow Creek that many people know, but it's a different Meadow Creek. Meadow Creek is a rather common name, and in fact, the Nez Perce National Forest has at least two Meadow Creeks on it. So Meadow Creek and some small tributaries called the South Fork Face. And those are the ones on the Clearwater National Forest. There are some other tributaries that come from the prairie, that flow into the South Fork of the Clearwater as well. Some of the adjacent watersheds that we're going to talk just briefly about, the Salmon River. In fact, historically, what makes the South Fork, it's a sort of a transition zone between the wetter country to the north and the drier country to the south. The Salmon River country, it's at really the southern fringe end of this wet, maritime-influenced climate that North Idaho is famous for, and northwest Montana and southeastern British Columbia, and just that far north, northeastern corner of Washington, and even a little bit, you can see in some of the mountains, the Blue Mountains, a little bit of that influence over in the Blues of northeast Oregon. But this, these inland wet belt forests, or we've called them coastal disjuncts in the past, have their most profound development in the Clearwater and then some of the rivers to the north, Coeur d'Alene. But the Salmon River is a much drier place, but historically the South Fork of the Clearwater flowed into the Salmon River. But about 13 to 17 million years ago, the Columbia River lava flow came and it diverted the river about where that big bend is. Anybody that knows where the big bend in the South Fork, it's right about at the boundary of the Nez Perce National Forest. It's coming and it's flowing west, right just below Mount Idaho, which is, some people call it a suburb of Grangeville. It's kind of funny. I think Grangeville would have a suburb, and it's detached. Actually, Mount Idaho was a town in of itself, and it was established before Grangeville. But
the
right about
the Blackerby Fire near there?
The Blackerby Fire. Right where the Blackerby Fire was, the river takes kind of make an elbow bend, and it heads north. And because of those lava flows, that's why it caused the change in the river channel to change. And most of the rivers above about Johns Creek, which is a little upstream from there, as I mentioned earlier, the formations, the parent material for that watershed is the very fragile Idaho batholith. Precipitation in the South Fork Clearwater country ranges from about 25 inches, and you'll find that out mainly on the prairie part, that very western part of its drainage, to about 50 inches or more in some of the upper watersheds. Some of the data and information I have says it can be as high as 80 inches in some of the higher elevations. The document prepared by the U.S. Forest Service, when they did an assessment of the South Fork Clearwater, they had both figures in it, so I guess you can choose which one you choose to believe. But on average, about 13 inches of water runs off of each acre of the South Fork drainage a year. Some of the soils are fairly rich. We know about the loess deposits that formed the Palouse Prairie and also part of the Camas Prairie. But there was also another major eruption that occurred within the time that human beings actually occupied North America, about 6 to 7,000 years ago, 6,700 years ago, Mount Mazama erupted.
And Mount Mazama, that's right.
And that is now Crater Lake in Oregon. It was a massive eruption, and the Nez Perce and other people that were living within this part of the world, some of the tribes there on the coast, I'm sure they must have wondered what this tremendous upheaval was. But it dumped a lot of ash. I think people were probably choked up for a good period of time. And ash cap soils were deposited all across the Clearwater country, and including the South Fork. Now, these ash cap soils, though, reached their deepest and sort of most profound up in the North Fork of the Clearwater. But they are still found in the South Fork and also in the some of the Salmon River country. That helps in some of the productivity. Because the South Fork used to flow into the Salmon, its vegetation is sort of is that transition, as I mentioned, between the Salmon River, the drier Salmon River country, and the wetter Clearwater country. It's in the South Fork of the Clearwater that you pick up the first cedars. You will have a few Pacific ewes that sort of reach their fingers over into the salmon drainage. I find them in Rapid River, a north flowing stream, and also in French Creek. And I believe another tributary further east in the River of No Return Wilderness. I'm not sure if it's Arctic Creek or which one, but there's another trib there that has Pacific ewe. But the first cedars start showing up in the South Fork drainage. But the funny thing is, you don't find them except maybe in a very rare instance, such as right around Elk City, south of that main branch of the South Fork River. There's some in and around kind of the Whiskey area. There was a proposed timber sale there that the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management proposed a while back, and a couple of conservation organizations challenged that, and so that sale was overturned. But the north end of Elk City Township, there's also some cedars found up in the American River drainage, now another one of the tributaries of the South Fork. So it's transition zone. When you look at the lower South Fork below, say, Johns Creek, you start seeing some of the more open hillsides and the grasslands. You start merging into that prairie country like the Camas Prairie. Yet in other drainages of the Clearwater, you tend to see a higher percentage of hardwood species, shrubs, and brush mixed in with those grasslands. But here in the South Fork, a little bit drier, so you don't tend to get some of those more water-loving shrubs that make up the bulk of elk winter forage. Mm. So a little bit drier. Again, you get a little bit drier sites. These ponderosa pine sites and some of those south-facing slopes can be very hot and dry throughout much of the year. Well, human history has been fairly extensive in the South Fork. Native peoples have used it for thousands of years, and there are several archaeological sites. When you look at the European history in places like the South Fork, mining and logging and grazing of livestock have all played a fairly big role and have all affected the water quality in the watershed of the South Fork. 1861, mining began near Elk City, what's now Elk City, Idaho. Some of this dredge mining and some of the early dredges, they would just basically rip up the stream bed and deposit it somewhere else. And that did a tremendous amount of watershed damage. And that damage is still not recovered today. And that's going to take probably a geologic time before it can be corrected. And the U.S. Forest Service and other entities like the Nez Perce Tribe are trying to recover some stream bottoms now by replacing some of the material, getting meanders back into streams, trying to do a little bit of restoration work. And that's very difficult to recover something that has evolved over thousands and millions of years, you know, the process there of the flow of a stream like the South Fork. So that's going to take a long time. But of all the tributaries of the Clearwater, the South Fork has seen by far the most mining and has had the biggest impact.
What were they mostly mining for?
Mostly mining for gold.
Okay.
Gold mines, looking for that precious metal. And there's some interesting history about the gold mines. There's also some on maybe the main stem of the Clearwater, up near Pierce, Idaho. Some of those tributaries that flow either into the main stem or also into, some of those actually flow into the North Fork. The hydrology up there on the Wiat Prairie is rather interesting as well. But about the same period of time, people were up there looking for gold, and that's what was the ultimate cause of the Nez Perce War in 1877. You had, years earlier, the federal government in 1855 had signed a treaty with the Nez Perce people. And all the South Fork of the Clearwater was Nez Perce homeland, and that was their treaty area. And these areas were not to be open to settlement or claim staking by miners. But nonetheless, they went in Pearson and other places and began that process, and that led to the war in that of 1877, and it also led to the government, as it usually does, I believe in 1863, though I'm not sure of the date. Well, it might have been 1866, renegotiated the treaty.
1863.
Mm-hmm. And redid the boundary and drastically shrunk the territory of the Nez Perce people. And they were sort of forced into this treaty. In fact, not all of them signed it. And that's what led again to the War of 1877. But a lot of these miners were escaping the Civil War. They didn't want to participate, even though they had certain loyalties. So thus you have some towns, although not in the South Fork Clearwater drainage, right on almost the boundary. It's in that, one of those areas that flows into Salmon, Dixie, Idaho, and it got its name from people from the South. So all these miners had a big effect early on the South Fork Clearwater. Logging, as I said, back historically was very high and had some major impacts on the watershed. And livestock grazing, although today not a major influence on the South Fork, still more significant than the other tributaries of the Clearwater. Oh, approximately 200,000 acres of the maybe, let's say, estimated 500,000 or 600,000 acres. So about a third of the national forest was within grazing allotments in the South Fork of the Clearwater, which is a higher percentage than either the Locksaw. You'll find the Locksaw Selway, which is the Middle Fork drainage, or the North Fork. In fact, hardly any in the North Fork, and I believe very little in the Selway and the Locksaw drainages, some in the Middle Fork Clearwater after they join a little further down. So those have all been influences on the South Fork. About Johns Creek, we'll talk a little bit about that creek a little bit later here. About Johns Creek is where the batholith ends and some of the more complex geology begins.
Is that moving north?
That's moving west.
Moving west, okay.
And then not long after Johns Creek, we're moving west, and then that river shoots up north. So there's a line approximately in there where you had these two plates, actually. Continental plates sort of ground together and made some of that thrusting and complex geology there. According to some of the documents prepared by the Forest Service on the Clearwater River and its water quality. Well, as I mentioned, drainages are important here in this part of the world because they are the highways, and I'm going to use that term loosely, for fish to get up. And that big influence, of course, being the anadromous fish, salmon and steelhead. Historically, the South Fork, not being a major tributary, probably only had a few fall Chinook, but it had certainly spring summer Chinook and steelhead. And, of course, West Slope Cutthroat, Bull Trout, Pacific Lamprey. Because of the construction, there was a dam at Harpster, an old dam at Harpster, and one built in 1927 at Lewiston, the power dam. While it did not, these dams were low enough, they did not completely prevent fish from coming up. It almost completely prevented the runs of the spring summer Chinook. The bigger fall Chinook, some of them still came up. But the spring summer Chinook, which are smaller fish and tend to spawn higher in the tributaries, were almost completely wiped out. Yet the steelhead were not. However, steelhead were very negatively affected by the dam at Harpster. So very few of them got above that, even though they historically had huge numbers in the Locksaw and Selway drainages. The removal of those dams, we've seen some recovery of the fishery, but the problem is the water quality in the South Fork. Of those drainages I mentioned, very few are largely unaffected by modern human activity. Johns Creek is one that tends to be relatively pristine.
That's an uninventoried roadless area.
That's an uninventoried roadless area right next. It had its headwaters in the Gospel Hump Wilderness. And then it goes down, and the Johns Creek roadless part should be part of the Gospel Hump. A part of Johns Creek's in the Gospel Hump, and the other part isn't. But that ought to be protected, and it's pretty much all unroaded country. Portions of 10 Mile Creek although not all of it. Most of Ten Mile Creek is pretty pristine and wild, and some of 20 Mile Creek. But the sad thing is both 10 Mile Creek and 20 Mile Creek and Wing Creek, which were up until recently all fairly pristine drainages, they were logged and developed by a plan in 1989, and it really wasn't implemented in, fully implemented until 1996 when the Otter Wing and the Mackey Day timber sales were sold, and that drastically affected the Wing Creek, Otter Creek, Huddleston Creek, and also upper portion of 10 Mile Creek. So there we have it, the South Fork Clearwater.
South Fork.
Just one last little interesting fact. 1964, the year of the big floods, South Fork, the least, you know, as I said, the least amount of flow from all the tributaries of the Clearwater, 17,500 cubic feet per second it was flowing in 1964. That is a tremendous amount of water. So that's a big river.
Wow. Thanks, Gary. Yeah, restoration ecology. We'll have to come, we'll talk about that a bit more in some subsequent shows.
There you have it, South Fork. Salmon steelhead, still important. Done a lot of restoration work, and that much of it, both in-channel and out-channel, has occurred in that South Fork Clearwater.
Well, we're going to get into a little more music here, and then we'll be back to talk about land sales.
That's right.
Sorrow gazed across the Pacific, looking for Peru to be specific. Pizarro was asked what was he doing, this requirement, who was it fooling? All the evil and damage I am able, what I relate to you, truth not fable. Not sure whether to laugh or cry, but I choose to keep my eyes dry. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told you eat this gold. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told you eat this gold. Courageous, ruthless, and also devious. Wretched soul, this was obvious. Her income believed all matter divine. The Spaniards would destroy them in time. Pizarro had with him the ultimate weapon. This invisible force sent them to heaven. Smallpox wiped out half the population. How this would help quicken the invasion. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told to eat this gold. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told to eat this gold. One who took the Spaniards for silence for nothing. Couldn't have seen them. Never underestimate the enemy. This easier for the conquered to see. Arrogance would bring it all but down. Now what we do this time around. Sorrow's horse stood to ink and crown. Foreshadowing, soon crown. Down. Would meet Pizarro the very next day. Came unarmed with much to say. Valverde called for the ambush to commence. For the Incas a devastating consequence. The Incas were trapped like ants in the square. And Walter's heart deep in despair. In with the horses, the swords and guns.
Now Pizarro could have his fun. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told you eat this gold. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told you eat this gold. Do you eat this gold? Yes, we eat this gold. So I have been told you
eat this gold. You're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. Some more music by Little Hawk. We're going to jump right in. We're gonna merge a couple segments in our show.
Yes, we are.
Talk about land sales. And
in that, we're going to award another Whopper.
Another Whopper.
Well, the big news has been the proposal to sell off some national forests and other lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management to fund management of those agencies, specifically something that was called the Craig Wyden Bill. Now, there was a formula, and I will call, and I'm using formula in a loose sense here, there was a formula for giving money to local counties from timber receipts off of federal lands. And that created a perverse incentive for counties to support massive amounts of logging on the national forests. And so it was, you know, a disincentive. It was a wrong incentive, and that led to, probably in part, situations like we saw in the South Fork, where logging in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was just tremendous. The watershed damage is still evident today. But after declines in timber sales, a lot of the big trees, of course, were basically gone, and conservationists became very concerned about water quality, as did people that fish for a living and others. It changed in federal policy somewhat. And because of that, the payments to these counties dropped from this formula that was developed by Congress. Now, whether or not Congress should have been funding local governments, the federal government funding state and local governments through the sale of national forest timber, or whether it should have been funding it at all is a question in and of itself. But Senator Wyden from Oregon and Senator Craig from Idaho got together and came up with a bill that would try to provide money to counties through another means rather than just timber sale receipts, recognizing that in some places timber sales had declined and were going to remain at lower levels because it just simply was unsustainable what was happening in the past. Well, that program is now up for renewal. And the Bush administration had proposed to sell off land to fund that program. Now, to me, that sounds like trying to pay your guard that's guarding the crown jewels of a country, telling him, well, he can take a jewel for his payment, you know, and then when it comes time to pay him again, well, he's going to have to take another jewel, and pretty soon the crown jewels are gone. But that's what the Bush administration was setting up here, it seemed to be. And surprisingly, this was not met with the much support from anybody in Congress, including people that are not known for their environmental stances. For example, Senator Wyden, whose environmental record is probably very mixed, said something to the he said, "I just don't think we can play Russian roulette with these local communities." He's from Oregon. And he said he promised to do everything I can to stop the plan.
And he was one of the drafters.
He's one of the drafters of the original bill that transferred the money away. So that's good. He didn't want land, national forest sold to fund the bill that he helped draft. He said it should come from other means. Senator Larry Craig from Idaho had a more visceral reaction. No, heck no, he told the Bush administration officials at the Senate hearing Tuesday. That is very interesting, because Senator Craig has not been known to be particularly concerned about the environment or public lands. At least he's got that reputation, but yet he is coming out on the right side because this proposal is so outrageous. So, Will, in conjunction with this, I think it's about time we're going to give an award.
I think so.
So we'll give that a little drum roll. And here we go. And to set up that, the Whopper of the Week, we'll have to read a little bit more from the AP account in this morning's Tribune. The administration has been touting this land sale as necessary. Well, many of us would argue that this is simply a way to get rid of public lands and then come back. Ironically, this is what Mark Rae, Undersecretary of Agriculture, told the committee of senators. We think this is justified as a one-time transition to help rural schools. All right. He said it's justified as a one-time transition. Yet, every year, the Bush administration has been cutting the budget for these kind of programs, saying that this is necessary for one time. Uh-uh. And that's where Undersecretary Rae is misleading and being dishonest with the public. This program will come back again if it continues. They will want to sell more public land and more public land to help fund, quote, rural schools till there's none left. As I use the analogy of the guard guarding the jewels, the guard is going to have to be paid. And every single year, these rural counties are going to need to have some money for the support of their schools. And if they have a program where the federal government, through the Craig Wyden bill, pays for it, then if we continue with that program, then it's going to have to be funded somehow.
When was this bill first authorized?
It was still authorized.
Or something?
Yeah, no, it was in the about 5 years ago.
Okay.
So it was a very popular bill and it had a lot of support. So.
And it was designed, as far as I know, so that these economies had a time frame to phase out.
Yes.
And come up with a broader base economy.
Right.
Which.
Right. Now, the bill is, now they're proposing to continue this program.
Right.
This is sort of a temporary program in the first place. You're right. But if it's going to become a permanent program, as some people are suggesting, then it certainly should not be funded from the sale of public lands.
That's right.
And whether or not it ought to be permanent, that's another issue. I've got, personally, I think there's some real problems with the bill and with this whole process. But nonetheless, I think it shows the craziness in this current administration with regard to our public lands by suggesting that they need to be sold to support this. And I think the senators on both sides of the aisle are right to say no, heck no, as Idaho's Larry Craig said.
Pretty desperate times if you're digging in the treasure chest, mm-hmm. trying to sell your family heirlooms just to, you know, keep the guns firing.
Yep.
So
that's about it.
That's it. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us on the Wild Clearwater Country Show.
KRFP Moscow, and we're going to Between the Lines.